It's the Rush Fancast, Jerry and Steve with you. Jerry, we thought we ran out of top fives, but I think we have another one.
We have at least this one. I don't know how many more there are to do, but this one might be the last one. But who knows? Maybe someone will send us some good ideas for other top fives.
There you go. Email us, therushcast@gmail.com. What top fives have we missed?
Right. We might as well just crowdsource this podcast till the end, right?
There we go. Crowdsourcing is always cool. You can find us on Twitter. We are at Rush Fancast. Instagram, find us at The Rush Cast. I just gave you the email. Lex did the bass intro and outro. He's the best. And Jer, you know what you usually do to start things out?
Tell a joke?
Oh, that would be great. Tell us a joke.
No, I'm not going to tell you a joke.
You don't have a joke.
I don't have a joke.
You do have an email, though.
I do. And it's from Felix, and he lives in Spain.
Hey, Felix.
He says, "Hi, Jerry and Steve. I've been listening to your podcast for almost 2 years now, and so far, I don't think you've read an email from someone from Spain. So, hola, ¿cómo estás?"
Hola.
First of all, I want to do the right thing. So here's my Rush origin story. I was 20 and in college. One day I was in bed with a fever, and my roommate gave me a tape to help me through that awful time. The cassette was A Show of Hands. And 34 years later, we're still friends and, of course, still Rush fans. I can never thank him enough. I've been thinking lately about a couple of things, and I would like to know what you both think about them. One is that when I hear you talking about the average number of times that your guests or yourselves have attended a live Rush show, that makes me so sorry because I never had the chance to see Rush live as they never came to Spain. So, can anyone be a real Rush fan without having gone to one of their shows? Obviously, I think the answer is a big yes. And anyway, I'd like to know what you think.
Oh, absolutely yes.
Yeah, absolutely. What are you going to do? You live in Spain and they never came to Spain.
Right. He's a real Rush fan.
Of course he's a real Rush fan.
Some people would disagree, but he's absolutely a real Rush fan.
Absolutely. 100%, Felix, you're a Rush fan. And the other question is, considering that Rush is, in a big part, a live band, a band that gained their following on the stage, and the huge number of times they have played, especially in the U.S. and Canada, don't you think that they could have visited the rest of the world more than they did? I mean, how many countries have they never visited? I remember the band's reactions to the shows in Brazil and the huge audience they had, even though they thought they didn't have many fans there. Now, I think the real reason why they didn't go to many countries is simply logistics.
I was just going to say, the word is logistics, period.
The shows were huge, and it was just difficult to travel.
When we talked to Dan Catullo, and he told us all the difficulties of Rush playing in Brazil, think about that times 10, 20 different countries.
Right.
I mean, they all wouldn't have been as difficult as Brazil, obviously.
Yeah.
But each of them would have had their difficulties.
Yeah. It's just a huge undertaking.
And as Rush's stage shows grew, the amount of people they had with them, all of that, like you said, logistics, when it was just the three of them touring Europe back, you know, in the early 70s, they could play anywhere.
Right.
But when their show became huge, forget about it. You agree?
Yeah, absolutely. And he says, "Anyway, I just wanted to let you know how fantastic this podcast is for us Rush fans. When I tell my friends and relatives that I listen to a podcast about a band and that the podcast has more than 150 episodes, they think I'm crazy." And I agree. I think we're crazy as well.
Imagine if you were the one creating the podcast. How crazy would you be then?
Thanks for the passion and the hard work. I really appreciate it. Right now, I have just listened to episode number 100, so it will take me some time to catch up with you. But when I get there, I hope you'll have read my email, and I will listen to you both sending me regards in Spanish. And he says, "Thank you very much. Brought to you by the letter F."
For Felix.
Right. Now, I was going to say something in Spanish, but I'm not.
I can't speak Spanish at all.
No. I mean, let's be honest. Our English isn't even that good.
The only Spanish I know, believe it or not, is from Sesame Street when I was a kid. You know, I know salida, You know,
that's and maybe a couple of lines from a Beck song here and there, right?
Maybe, yeah. Guero, right?
Guero, right, yeah. So he has a PS at the end. He says, I have a completely amateur website where I write my humble reviews about albums I like. It's a lifetime project that obviously I will never complete, but it's my dream and my mission. Anyway, as you know, the point of the journey is not to arrive. So he has a website. It's www.felixgjc.com. And of course, he has a section on Rush, which is www.felixgjc.com/rushpal.html.
Nice. You're going to have to rewind the podcast to get all that.
That's right.
But you can do it.
Yeah, and now I'm excited for him. A year from now, maybe around that time, if he's listening to one a week, he'll hear this and be very happy.
There you go. There you go. Thanks so much, Felix, for the email. Thanks so much for listening. We really appreciate it. Our first email from Spain, hopefully not our last.
That's right.
So, Jer, as we mentioned, we've got another top five for you today, and our guest that's going to help us with the top five describes himself on his Instagram as imaginative, realist, dark artist. He's the man behind the incredible artwork on Kevin J. Anderson's final collaboration with Neil Peart, Clockwork Destiny, and also happens to be a huge Rush fan. Steve Otis, welcome to the Rush Fancast.
Well, thank you for having me.
We like to start out by asking our guest, Steve, their Rush origin story. When did you first hear Rush, and how did you become a fan?
Well, let's see. Way back in 1978. But I think I was about 15, and one of my buddies got a hold of Hemispheres. And I was at his place, and he goes, you know, there's this, I got a record from this Canadian band. I was like, man, Canadian. You know, like, I was into British prog and all that kind of stuff, you know, Genesis and Yes. So, you know, Canadian band. Blah. So pop that on the turntable and you're like, oh, hang on a second. So I was pretty much smitten from that day on, I'd say. Then it was really cool. They were Canadian. So was I. So I was like, that was something to identify with.
By this time, you were already interested in art, right?
Yeah, I was pretty much, I pretty much grew up with a pencil in my hand and, you know, crayons and whatever. From a very early age, I was always drawing something or making little comic strips or drawing Batmans or dinosaurs or anything that was pretty much fantastic. Or already at that young age, I was an imaginative realist.
And you were very much into comics, I had read, right?
Yeah, I kind of grew up with, you know, the whole DC Marvel universe. Being in French Canada, I was also into things like Asterix and Tintin, which is a little more like European comics. As I got older, I got into the Warren magazines, which were published in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, called Eerie and Creepy, which were like horror anthology comics, which featured a lot of amazing artists in black and white. And that's where my whole love for the whole dark art and horror genre kind of popped in. Like at, you know, around 12 or 13, I get my monthly subscriptions and like I just go crazy looking at all the art and they're like, wow, I just hope someday I can get to be to that level. So a lot of practicing, and I still am.
Now, when you got these Rush albums when you were young, what did you think of the artwork on the covers?
Well, like most people I don't know if most people who my age back then, but the album cover always spoke to me a lot. Like I would like lay in my bed, like with the album sleeve and just pore over it while I listened to the album. So that was like for all the Rush albums and all the other bands I had. If the album cover wasn't cool for some odd reason, couldn't really get into it. There were some exceptions, but usually speaking, you judge, you know, we say not to judge a book by its cover, but I'd go to record stores and I'd look at the artwork on the covers and you're like, oh yeah, like this has got to be good because the cover is so amazing.
That's why we don't say you can't judge an album by its cover, because everybody does, right?
Well, there you go. I mean, there's some pretty shabby album covers out there that contain some great music, but in Rush's case, I'd have to say that they pretty much hit it every time. There's a couple of clunkers, in my opinion, but I mean, most of them are pretty cool.
So you mentioned you're in French Canada, Steve. Yeah. Did Rush get up there on tour very often?
Rush, they mostly played Montreal. So I was fortunate enough to see the Moving Pictures mm-hmm. tour. So that's my claim to the, I saw a mythical Rush tour. Actually, I was supposed to see the Hemispheres tour, but I was 15 and my parents wouldn't let me drive up to Montreal with a buddy. Although I did have the $8 to buy the ticket.
$8.
At the Montreal wow. Forum Concert Bowl, which is like half of the forum. So finally in 1981, when I was like almost 18, like I got the permission to go see them. March 27th, 81, I think the tickets were like $10.50 at the Montreal Forum and with Max Webster opening. So that was the first Rush show. But it started coming to Quebec City on the Signals tour. And the following year, and I saw every tour since then. Two reasons: I'm a fan, and second of all, from 84 to 97, I worked security at our local concert forum. So whenever there was a Rush concert, I'd beg my boss, "Can I be at the soundboard?" And I'll watch the soundboard.
Make sure no one steals the soundboard.
There you go. So you know, I got to know Howard Ungerleiter pretty well. So you're like, oh, here's the guy again, you know, like, then I try to be discreet and like not just gush all the time, but it was kind of cool. It's kind of a little arrangement I have with my boss. I said, well, you know, for the other shows you can put me in the garage backstage, mm-hmm. you know, I don't mind, but Rush, I'd like to see the show. So you know, my excuse would to be at the soundboard.
So your career, Steve, and Rush sort of intersected when you connected with Kevin J. Anderson. Can you tell us how that happened?
Yeah, that was a pretty interesting, well, it's a pretty interesting story in the sense that I was aware of Kevin Anderson, like after reading most of Neil's books and about this author friend he had and all that. And so I'd read Clockwork Angels and Clockwork Lives. And so I added him to my Facebook page. And, you know, I was following him on Facebook. And he made a post shortly after Neil's death. And he said, he wrote something like, I'm thinking of re-editing Drum Beats, you know, a book, a small novella story that I wrote with Neil. And, you know, just made a little post. And so I just commented underneath, well, if you need a cover, you know, I'll do it. So I'm throwing something out there into the ocean. You know, you guys never heard of me and whatever. A couple of minutes later, I get a message like, are you serious about the cover? I said, sure, you know, I'll gladly do it. You know, like I'll do it for free. no problem there. So it was like, I might take you up on that. Like, so he says, I'll take a look at your stuff. And yes, he must have thought it was kind of cool. So he said, sure, like do the covers and the cover. And would you like to do some interior art? So some black and white illustrations. So I said, sure, not a problem. So that's how it all started, just by a little Facebook post. So yeah, Facebook, you know. Sometimes things come out of that that area.
So what is it like working with someone else's idea? Is it completely different from doing your own paintings?
Well, yeah, in a sense. But I mean, Kevin left me a lot of leeway. I mean, he just basically said, here's the story. It's like it's 29 or 30 pages. So read through it and send me a few sketches. So I sent him a few sketches, four or five sketches, and he right away chose, I think it was the second one, said, that's the one. Just a little, you know, basic pencil scribble. He said, I know like you're good with colors and all that, and I like the composition, so we'll take that one. And so it was as simple as that. He's kind of a dream to work with, because he's not one of those art directors kind of guys who will be like, you know, you got to put this in it, you got to put that, try to not put this. And a lot of people who will, how could I say, art direct artists, they don't necessarily know what works and what doesn't work. So as an artist, sometimes you'll go, well, yeah, this, it's a good idea, but the composition won't work on like a small book cover or a small CD cover or whatever. But Kevin's like really positive about the input and all that. And everything we discussed, he was always like, sure, you're the artist, go ahead. So that was pretty cool.
So when it came time to do Clockwork Destiny, Kevin reached out to you again, did he not?
Yeah, that was a surprise. Actually, his publishing company kind of killed the surprise because I got an email from ECW Press saying, "We've talked to Kevin. He wants you to do Clockwork Destiny as a cover. Are you interested?" And I said, "Sure, like, yeah, no problem." And so I wrote back to him, and he was like, "Shit, I was supposed to tell you like next week." So that was pretty cool. So that was in summer of, I think, 2021. Once again, did a few sketches, submitted the sketches. He approved them and took it from there. The cover in itself, I mean, it's rather small on the book, but if you see, like, with the print that's been released, there's a couple of Easter eggs in the painting where you do some little Rush references. So if people have a keen eye, they can, you know, analyze the print and try to find them out.
Now I'm going to have to find the larger print of that to see what I can find.
There you go. There's still some available directly from Kevin.
Nice.
Made a limited run of 150.
So did Rush's music at all inspire you to create that image?
Definitely. Well, as I said, Clockwork Angels was, I think, one of their best albums, from all of them. So I put that on a few times while I was like trying to get in the mood, and went reread Clockwork Angels. I got an advanced copy of Clockwork Destiny, so which I was not allowed to divulge any information. So I kind of read that and just, okay, so here's what the ship looks like. He was really adamant about having, you know, the snow dog on the cover and an airship and some kind of like northern lights. So that was all the art direction I got. Like, you know, snow dog, big ship, balloons, and northern lights, and a lot of ice, which was a challenge because I'm not necessarily a painter who uses a lot of cold colors. So I don't use a lot of blues and greens. I'm a very warm color guy with all my art. So, and if you look at that painting, most of it is blue and green. So it was quite a challenge.
And did you draw any inspiration from some of like the older science fiction paperback books from like maybe the 30s or 40s?
Well, yeah, I was a big fan of Frank Frazetta, still am. So basically all the Conan books, Arthur, Conan Doyle, all Edgar Rice Burroughs, all those old authors. I went through those, Isaac Asimov, 2001 A Space Odyssey, you name it. I mean, read all that like as a teenager and definitely got the creative juices flowing with those things.
Now, I couldn't help but notice on your Facebook page, Steve, the amazing, I don't know whether it's a drawing or a painting of Geddy Lee. Is Rush a frequent subject for you?
Interestingly enough, no. I did the Geddy Lee painting as just as a fun little project because I was doing an exhibition on music icons. And, you know, I had like a whole bunch of them, and I finally said, I got to make one of the guys of Rush. And I figured, I mean, if you want to paint one guy, you want to paint Geddy because he has such distinct traits. So he's, you know, it's really easy to capture. And interestingly enough, that painting was sold. It wasn't even dry yet. It was on my easel. I posted a picture and somebody pops up like, "I want that piece of art." And like, "Okay, great. You know, give me a day. It'll dry up and I'll ship it out to you."
I noticed that you do a lot of rock artists. Do you listen to a lot of music while you're painting?
Strangely enough, no. I'm pretty much usually when I paint, I don't really have any music or pretty much in silence. Sometimes maybe just a CBC radio, which is just blabbing and talking. So music, for some odd reason, being a musician, if I'm listening to something, I'm concentrating also on the music and a little bit less on the art. So I'm not saying I never do it, but sometimes.
Well, we thought it would be fun today, Steve, to have you help us choose our top five favorite Rush album covers. I wanted to start out by asking you guys, how difficult a task was this for you? Jerry, what did you think?
Well, like every top five list that we've done so far, this was really hard. It's always hard, right? There's just so many great album covers. And maybe it's because we're fans. And like you said, Steve, when I was younger, I would get the albums and just look at the albums while I was listening to them. So there's a deep connection to some of these album covers. But there are so many great album covers.
Was this hard for you, Steve?
It was pretty difficult, you know. They have like, I'm not counting the live albums, but I mean, with just the 20 studio albums, I'm going, okay. And as an artist, like, I have my favorites, and some of them, as I said, to me, I think U Syme did a great job on every one of them, but some of them just didn't speak to me, and so those kind of got chucked out pretty quickly. But then to choose the top five, it was like, what do I put first?
Yeah.
Really, it was really tough. I actually had to print them out, you know, like, to remind me. That's a sign of age there, guys.
So why don't we count from five up to one, and Steve, we'll start with you with your number five Rush album cover. What do you say?
Okay, my number five right here is Roll the Bones.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so it's on the bottom of my list. To me, it was an album that reconnected me with Rush, because I kind of lost a bit of interest in the 80s. Not a lot, but the whole keyboard area and keyboard years, and then the designs for those album covers didn't really speak to me. Roll of Bones, like, there was like a skull. It was kind of dark. There was something a little bit very Hypnosis about it. I don't know if you know that company that made album covers for Pink Floyd and Alan Parsons Project and all that, but it really looked like something like that. When I saw it, I said, oh, this is cool. And I remember, like, back then there was no vinyl anymore, so I had it on a little cassette. And I was like, even on a small cassette, this speaks to me. So that's my number five.
As soon as you said that, I was like, it's because it has a skull on it, right? That's the real reason.
All right, Jar, what's your number five?
Well, I'm going to go with 2112.
Oh, wow.
It's so simple, but it tells you so much about what the album is about. And, you know, the star, and I guess on the inside is the star man. But that star has become, you know, like one of their de facto kind of icons for the band. It's just stayed with them since it came out.
Yeah, the whole pentagram kind of thing, that was, to me, is like, are these guys satanic? Or and you look at the back of the album, like, no, they're wearing kimonos. These guys are not devil worshippers.
No, not at all.
That's a good choice, Jer. Good choice.
What do you have, Steve?
Well, for my number five, I decided to go with one of Hugh's minimalist covers. And this is the one that I find the most striking. It's Counterparts.
Huh.
The Nut and the Bolt in gold on the blue background is just stunning and memorable. I pulled up a quote from U Syme. This is from Louder. He did an article about his own album covers. And he said, what band in all of rock and roll would allow their art director to propose with a straight face a diagram of a nut and a bolt for such a potentially vast word as Counterparts? So vast a word, Neil and I could not stop thinking big, so we didn't.
Huh.
For weeks and weeks. What do you guys think of that one?
That's pretty interesting, actually, because the nut and the bolt are a counterpart in themselves, in the simplest form.
Wow. I'm so surprised by that, Steve. I don't know why.
You don't like that one?
No, I do. It was on my original short list, but it didn't make the cut. It's such a simple idea. I wonder, what do you guys think of the fact that it's an album cover for the CD age, as opposed to having such a big canvas for albums? The concepts could be a little bit larger. Maybe that one is a little bit less dense because of it's on CD.
Well, I think they have a point in the sense that, you know, CD being about, you know, 4 or 5 inches by 4 or 5 inches. I mean, a lot of albums covers from the 70s, once they came out in CDs, I mean, you lost a lot of the detail. So you're keeping things simple. It's a very straightforward design and it works. There was no point in making album art that contained all these incredible details and all this incredible art, because it was so small. And even if you had it as a poster inside, it didn't fold out to be that big. So I think simple, better, less is more, you know.
Yeah, and Hold Your Fire came out around the same time too. And that was another simple one, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. But that was on vinyl. So that actually, it's interesting. Hold Your Fire, the interior cover to me is far superior to the outside one.
Yeah.
I remember taking it out going, this should have been the cover.
And I think that's what Hugh had initially intended, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think he did.
I think so. I think I remember reading that somewhere.
All right, Steve, we're to your number four. What do you got for number four?
Okay, number four for me is Hemispheres.
Oh, good one.
Which, according to, I think, Usaim, had said that it was a god-awful montage of just cut-out pictures. To me, it spoke to me because it looked like a Magritte painting.
Yeah.
And also, when I saw it at a very young age, I was still at that age where I figured, like, why is there a naked person on the cover? I mean, this is, like, I could not bring that home. So yeah, it's kind of quirky. It's kind of like, it's not Photoshop, but you know, the guy in the brain, like the floating brains in back. So that it spoke to me a lot. And I mean, the music inside it was just like completely crazy. I mean, so it was a pretty good package to me.
Yeah, that was also on my list that I had to cross out like 10 minutes before we started recording.
All right, Jer, what's your number four? Let's hear it.
My number four is Signals.
Ah, good one.
Because, again, it's just, I think I'm just going with the iconic album covers from Rush. Again, it's a very simple one. And that red fire hydrant and the Dalmatian, you see it all the time, pops up in reference to Rush. If you see a Dalmatian next to a fire hydrant, at least I'm thinking Rush. I don't know what the average person is thinking. But, you know, it conveys, again, a lot about the concept of the album itself, where this Dalmatian is getting signals from other dogs in the neighborhood. I just think it's a very clever photo.
Definitely is. To me, it wasn't one of my favorites.
No?
No, I remember when it came out. I mean, I bought it the day it came out. And back pre-internet days, you had no idea, like, what this thing was going to come out. It was like, you'd get, like, right. Somebody would start talking. I hear there's a new album from Rush coming out. Oh, you know, they go to the record store. Here's the album. And, you know, we had just gone from Moving Pictures, which we'll talk about later. And to me, this was like kind of bland. Hmm. And it reflected to me what was on the album. Guys searching for a new style. Because to me, Signals is kind of like Moving Pictures. We're trying to get out of Moving Pictures, but we're still stuck in that style and we're breaking out a little bit. So I feel a cover is very indicative of what's inside. Don't expect what you've already heard. And it was a hard one for me to get into. I mean, tracks like The Weapon and Digital Man, it took a while to sink in because that dance beat just didn't get to me at all.
Right.
That 4/4 bass drum, didn't work for me.
Now, do you think that you didn't like the album cover as much because you didn't like the music as much? Do you think that had something to do with it?
Well, actually, when I saw the album, I went like, this is just kind of strange. You know, like I was expecting, I mean, I was still expecting, you know, the Hemispheres era Rush and the Permanent Waves and all that. And so when I actually listened to the album, I mean, it started out with a bang and then it petered out. And over time, I appreciated it a lot more. But back in 1982, I was like, you know, a prog head, and anything that was remotely reggae or techno or too synthy, it was kind of a bit of a turnoff. But I mean, you know, I was only 18. What did I know?
Steve, what do you have for number four?
Well, coincidentally enough, my number four is also Signals.
Oh, I thought you were going to say Hemispheres.
Again, just like you said, Jer, another simple image, but the colors to me just pop on this. The red hydrant, the green grass, the black and white Dalmatian against that light tan background. And then you got the font, which is kind of brushed, right?
So 80s.
Yeah, it's very 80s, but this is 1981, Steve, right?
It was.
Shouldn't it be 80s?
It should be. It's just like back then, it was like, you know, I wanted it to still be the prog 70s. I was not ready for the new wave Rush.
I'm going to read the phrase that Hugh wrote. He had it as his number five favorite album cover because he listed his top 11.
Oh.
Top 11?
Yeah, he simply said, the fire hydrant and the fire dog. This deceptively simple end result of an otherwise everyday occurrence in the dog world was the culmination of 3 months of conceptual cul-de-sacs. I like how graphically the primary and secondary colors worked while depicting the theme with some still unsettling and unexpected whimsy. A moment from Twin Peaks.
Wish I had said that.
It's interesting to hear that the guy who designed it, what his thoughts are on these things.
Yeah,
for sure. So, Steve, we're to your number three. What you got for us?
We're down to my number three. Okay. So number three, I have moving pictures. Okay.
Nice.
I just love the whole wordplay, the whole composition, the triple arches, all the people moving pictures, you know, the whole kind of like setup. There was something, the black background with the red rush, that just grabbed me right off the bat. I mean, it was the album. To me, as I think it's Getty who says it in their documentaries, like 1981 was the year of Rush. I mean, it was like, you know, what are you doing? We're going to see Rush. That was the event. And that album, the whole design of it, a bit reminiscent of 2112 for the red and black, which I thought was always a cool color combination. And I like the whole photo composition of it. And it just works.
Can't argue with that. Jer, what's your number three?
Well, my number three is one that I know reflects the turmoil of the recording process, and that's Grace Under Pressure.
Great one.
Because there's a lot of weird stuff on this album cover. First of all, the album, all the colors, I don't even know how to describe it. Steve, how would you describe the colors that are used on Grace Under Pressure?
To me, Grace Under Pressure is icy cold blue.
There you go.
And Flex, definitely the music inside.
Yeah.
That was the one thing to me when I first saw the album, once again, pre-internet. So this comes out and I'm going, okay, so there's kind of an android head and there's this, right, an eye in the background and it's kind of like abstract. I thought it was cool because it was a real painting, and I remember like getting a feeling of coldness from it. And I remember like listening to the album, like the first time, first run through going, it's very sterile. And as a musician, I was going, yeah, I don't know. There's a lot of electronic drums. The guitar solo have changed into textural solos. So we're very far from Limelight and the La Villa Strangiato. So to me, it was like, I'm not sure I'm liking this a lot. And so it kind of, you know, the cover to me was also the same thing. Not sure I like this a lot for Rush, you know?
I love this android figure on the left. And what I love about it is that you can't see its face.
Yes. That eye in the background, we're not sure what it is.
Right.
Could be a bird.
There's also like a jawbone and some teeth,
yeah,
hanging out in there.
Yeah.
And then again, there's another, you know, the Grace Under Pressure mathematical symbol, which, yes, for the longest time, I'm like, why is it P over G? I don't know why it didn't click for me for like 10 years. I'm like, oh, it's Grace, yeah, Grace Under Pressure. And it splits the painting right where the two halves, the turmoil on top and the slightly less turmoil on the bottom. And then the painting and then the water on the bottom is also spilling outside of, you know, the image itself, sort of like a Pink Floyd album.
Actually, once again, what I would have liked was that image of the egg in the vise. And to me, that would have been a perfect album cover for that album. But once again, I think it was inside or in the... It was on the back because it's the portrait of Josef Karsch is back on that.
What Hugh Syme wrote, he has this as his number two favorite album cover. And he says, by now, we had really hit our stride as a band and art director. I was really enjoying the process of how Neil and I could discuss and jam on ideas, sometimes with immediate yields and sometimes only finding the first of many. My initial inclination was to venture into an ultra-minimal, almost ECM jazz label feel. And in that cover's frame, depict a field of heavy tone over a calmer hue, so we would have pressure weighing down Grace, sky and water. That's when it occurred to me that this also could be a fraction with P literally over G. Then we found ourselves heading into more metaphorical, surreal direction for the final themes of the painting. And I also enjoyed that process, painting, something we only ventured into a few times, hence, I still have the working sketch I did that evening on a paper napkin.
That's pretty cool. I think that's one of their last albums to feature like an actual painting.
Really is spectacular.
I wonder who has the original of that.
I wonder who has it.
I don't know.
I always wonder a lot about like a lot of album art. Like, do the artists still own the original art, or like has it been sold to a fan or a collector? Or
if I'm not mistaken, Neil had it in his office. The painting itself, which is evidently is very large. Okay. He had it in his office since the album came out. So I'm not sure where it is now.
There you go.
So my number three is also moving pictures. Jerry, we've talked about the triple meaning of this cover, which is amazing. The red on black, like you said, Steve, is just striking.
It pops out.
And the photograph is iconic. The legislative building in Toronto, the red jumpsuits jump out to me too. And it's just iconic. It's incredible.
To me, it has the same quality as a Norman Rockwell painting.
Yeah.
The same composition, like that kind of something was, people are posing for something. And you can tell it's set up, it's staged. It doesn't look natural, even though they want it to look natural. So that's the whole key to this. So it has that kind of like Americana feel, or maybe Canadiana if you want. but it just screams Norman Rockwell to me. So it's for some odd reason.
Hugh Syme chose this as his number one.
Wow. Yeah.
And he says, despite budgetary limitations for that time and the challenges this concept posed, it was a pretty ambitious piece to undertake from the cover to the inner sleeve. I'm pleased that the outcome was so close to my initial vision. And like some songs, this one came to me in an instant. Neil's titles are like that. So he heard Moving Pictures and immediately thought, I'm going to have dudes moving pictures. Why not?
Or you could have Bavarian waitresses moving pictures too.
There you go. All right. We're to number two. Steve, what do you got for number two?
Okay. This was a tough one because it was almost my number one, but at the last minute I kind of changed. So my number two is Permanent Waves.
Nice.
To me, it had this whole, I mean, I'm a sci-fi guy. I mean, definitely. So this whole kind of like post-apocalyptic image of a hurricane, there's turmoil, everything's topsy-turvy. And you have this like supermodel, like, you know, just walking by as if, not a problem here. So, yeah, and to me, it was something fresh, something new. And although I was saying I wasn't into the whole the 80s rush, to me, Permanent Waves announced, when I first saw the cover, I was thinking like B-52s. I mean, the Police. Mm. And so, you know, kind of weary of, what am I going to hear inside?
Right.
But, you know, I was pleasantly surprised 6 times.
It's a great choice. Great choice. Jer, what do you have for number two?
Well, this was a tough one for me, but I decided to go with A Farewell to Kings.
Wow. Okay. Good one.
For a lot of reasons, it is a very strange album cover, if you ask me, right? There's the dead-looking marionette on a throne. There's the bombed-out building. There's a smokestack in the background. It's such a desolate image that somehow conjures up what the title song is all about. I just love it that the ability to take a theme from the written word and put it into some kind of art. So I love this album cover.
I agree.
I love it too. It's very similar to Permanent Waves too, just with all the different images on one canvas, so to speak.
Right.
Now, strangely, Hugh Syme did not put either Permanent Waves or A Farewell to Kings in his top 11.
Oh, that's odd.
How about that?
Yeah, it's really strange.
There's no accounting for taste. I'm not sure why.
I can understand if you put Caress of Steel, that's for sure. But
Well, my number two is also Permanent Waves.
Huh. Wow. You guys are on the same wavelength.
Pretty much in sync there.
We are in sync. This is one I think you'd be thrilled to have hanging on your wall. At least I would be. The model is stunning. The picture of the Galveston seawall from 1961 is just iconic. And I think this fits the music too, you know? I mean, I see this and I hear Jacob's Ladder.
There you go.
There's so much going on here. And, you know, just the fact that the album's so great to me makes the album cover even greater.
And it's in black and white, right? Which is an odd choice for something that's supposed to grab your attention on a rack, right?
Yeah.
And it took me a long time to realize that it's written Permanent Waves across the Rush.
Right.
I'd be looking
right across it.
I'd be concentrating on the picture, and then the title's here. Didn't pop out at first.
But this is a good example of an album cover that loses some of the references in it when you shrink it down, right? Because there are really cool things in the background that you just can't see if it's on a cassette or a CD cover.
You know, I take it back, Jar. Hugh did pick A Farewell to Kings in his top 11. It is number 11.
It's number 11.
There you go.
He didn't describe the reason. He just kind of threw it in. He was supposed to do a top. He was supposed to do a top 10, and then he threw in Farewell to Kings for 11.
Right. From what I read about you, Simon, I think he had a lot of opinions about what was done with, you know, collages or montages in the 1970s. And just because back then, we didn't have computers to cut and paste things. So it was actually literally like cut out images and superimpose things. So technically, I think you had a lot of problem with those albums going, it could have been better, you know.
Right. We forget that the term cut and paste comes from the fact that people used to literally cut and then paste things together.
I'm old enough to have done that. I've worked as a graphic artist and I've cut and paste texts. So yeah. I'll tell you, that's a challenge. You don't know if you guys know what letraset is, but that was a hell of a challenge to write out a whole word with this little thing you just kind of like, you know, put on a page and just scrimped on it till it transferred.
Wow. So,
that was the old days.
So, Steve, what is your number one?
Okay, my number one is A Farewell to Kings.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. Because it's once again, the whole post-apocalyptic thing that spoke to me, and that puppet just looked so damn weird.
Right.
And like you said, you got the smokestack in back. It reminded me, I don't know if it reminded me, because I think I bought Farewell to Kings like beginning of the 80s. It reminded me of Supertramp's Crisis, What Crisis, which was kind of similar of a guy sitting in a lawn chair in the middle of some kind of like a junkyard or something. And I remember when I saw it, I said, seems I've seen this before. And then I kind of made the correlation. But actually, once again, it's an interesting cover because Rush were still in that kind of medieval kind of proggy trip. And the cover, apart from the puppet kind of guy, looks very industrial and very like, dirty and stuff. So you're not expecting, once again, the kind of music, you're certainly not expecting Xanadu inside of that.
Right.
Or the intro to Farewell to Kings or Madrigal. I mean, Cygnus X1, okay. That's kind of like a bit of a, you know, very, a lot of turmoil in it. But a lot of the music is very bucolic and very pastoral and very beautiful. And the cover is just kind of, it's completely the opposite.
And this mannequin, if you want to call it that, this puppet kind of looks like a court jester to me.
Yeah. I mean, you want to say, fuck you, puppet.
Well, that was one that almost made it into my top five. So that gives away that it's not my number one. I think I know what your number one is, though, Jer, since you haven't mentioned it yet.
No, of course. It's the cover of my favorite Rush album, Moving Pictures. So the thing I love about Moving Pictures, and you see this a lot with other album covers too, where people love to recreate album covers on their own. Do you know what I mean? Like they'll hold up the album cover in the place where the photo was taken and the rest of it just kind of fills in behind them. And that's just how iconic Moving Pictures is to Rush fans. It is like a play. People go to the legislative building because it's on the album cover. And people just love the three arches, even though that, you know, obviously whoever built the building didn't intend it to have just three arches, but it's just represents Rush. You know what I mean? It just does.
I think it's a great choice, but the question I have is, could you recreate any of the other album covers? Like, do I want to shave my head and recreate this? Grace Under Pressure?
I'm already halfway there.
Right. I meant recreate it in the real world, like go to, like, I remember I don't remember what site it was, but there was this photographer who went around trying to find out where classic album covers, where the photo was taken. He did Simon and Garfunkel album. He also did the Free Will and Bob Dylan, tried to find that street or whatever.
Who's Next?
I don't know if he did Who's Next. I think Who's Next, where they were peeing on the obelisk from 2001, right?
Yeah.
Something like that. I think the first Black Sabbath album, the that house still exists. I've seen pictures of that.
Really?
So that's a real place. You know, there's some people actually will, you know, I mean, if I definitely go to Toronto one day, I'm going to be a geek enough to go in front of that building and get my
right,
pictures.
Right, of course.
You know?
Of course you will.
Maybe not in a red jumpsuit, but yeah.
Now that'd be the cool way to do it, in a red jumpsuit. Right.
Yeah, there you go.
It always, red jumpsuit always reminded me of the jumpsuits that Devo used to wear. Theirs were like the nuclear kind of outfits you would wear if you were going to. Right, the flower pot heads. So, Steve, what is your number one?
Care to guess what it is?
Got to guess what it is.
Sure.
What don't you have on there? Hemispheres.
No.
Oh.
It is also Grace Under Pressure. I'm surprised. Oh. First of all, I'm surprised, Steve, you didn't pick Grace Under Pressure.
I don't know. Like I said, it was not their best period to me. So it's one of those weird albums covers that even today, I kind of look at it going, yeah, I get it now. well, I get it now. There's a couple of songs. The Enemy Within, I still don't get. But for the rest, you know, it was 1983. So there you go. There's synth drums, there's synths, and Alex just stopped playing real solos. For to me, it was a bit of a deception, but I grew to enjoy it. And, you know.
Well, for me, this is just far and away Hugh's best cover. Like we were talking about, the colors meld together so well, fits the music perfectly. And to me, it should be hanging in an art museum. That's how beautiful this is.
Well, as a painting, it works. If you just show me a painting, you say, here's a painting. We're not telling you what it is. It's just a painting. It just works 100%.
Right. If I went into an art museum and saw that hanging on the wall, I would not be surprised.
No, not at all.
Not at all. So, Steve, have you done any album covers in your career?
I've done a couple of album covers for underground metal bands. That's about as far as it goes. Or some, you know, people that I knew who had bands in the area. So, you know, heavy metal stuff, you know, because it's associated a lot with, you know, with the type of art I do, the whole dark art thing. So that's what I've done. And no really known bands, though. So I'm not the next Hugh Syme, that's for sure.
Now, if our listeners want to see more of your work, where can they do that?
My website, Steve Otis Artist, is available, as well as my Facebook Steve Otis Artist page, where I'm getting close to 23,000 followers on that. So I guess somebody must like the stuff.
And do you do commission work, if our listeners would be interested in something like that?
Yeah, sure. I do commission work. Right now I got a couple of things that I'm working on presently. So it's a reasonable wait. You don't have to wait a whole year if you want some original art. But, you know, I've been selling pieces pretty much all over the globe in the last years. I've sold paintings in Malaysia, Germany, Italy, you name it. Internet's great for that. That's things we didn't have when I started out as an artist in the 80s. Like, it was all word of mouth, or you had to know somebody who knew someone else. Nowadays with the internet, well, I mean, it's just exploding. So you'll pop a piece of art on your site and next thing you know, you're selling it to a guy somewhere halfway across the world. So that's kind of cool in itself. You know, shipping is always a bit of a nightmare, but you always wonder, is the thing going to get there in one piece? But I take great care of my shipping and my packing. So.
Well, thanks so much for joining us today, Steve, to help us choose our top five Rush album covers. We really appreciate it and have a great day.
Well, thanks. That was a pretty fun exercise, harder than I thought. So thanks again.
So, Jer, what a great idea you had having Steve on to talk about our top five album covers. He was the perfect guest for that.
Well, Steve, I have to say it wasn't my idea entirely. A listener named Wayne added us in an Instagram post with a suggestion that we talk to Steve. And I'm glad I took his suggestion. Steve was very funny and entertaining.
And he's a huge Rush fan. If he wasn't, we wouldn't have had him on.
And I'm also surprised at how little overlap we had with these album covers.
I think we had a little bit of overlap, but not...
I just assumed we were going to have all of them would be the same. That's what I was thinking going into it.
Really?
Yeah. Maybe that's just very self-centered of me to think that everyone would like what I like.
So do you want to hear Hugh Symes' top 11?
Yeah, sure.
In its entirety?
Again, why is it 11?
Because he threw in A Farewell to Kings at the end after he did his top 10 and said, it just said, oh, and I always liked A Farewell to Kings too.
Oh. Sure, let's hear it.
So number 10 is Clockwork Angels.
Oh, yeah.
Number 9 is Vapor Trails. Number 8 is Test for Echo. Number 7 is Counterparts. Number 6 is Roll the Bones. Number 5 is Signals. Number 4 is Hold Your Fire. Mm. Number 3 is Power Windows, one that we didn't mention, which we probably should have.
I know. Well, when Steve mentioned paintings, that's the other one I thought of. I think that's a painting as well.
Yes, it is. Number 2 is Grace Under Pressure. And number 1, like you, is Moving Pictures.
Hmm. It's interesting to hear his own thoughts on his own work. It was also interesting to talk to him when we did about all these album covers.
Yeah, I just had to go with Grace Under Pressure. I thought, which one do I want hanging up on my wall? That's the one.
Right, right. I was trying to go for a little more iconic ones that, to me, you know, just screamed the average Rush fan, Rush.
That makes sense. Makes sense. You can find us on Twitter. We are at RushFanCast. Instagram, find us at TheRushCast. Email Jerry. Let him know what you thought of our conversation with Steve Otis. Tell us your top five Rush album covers. TheRushCast@gmail.com. Lex did the bass intro and outro. He's the best. And Jerry's got a great quote to wrap us up.
Yes, it's from Between the Wheels.
Ah, Grace Under Pressure.
Grace Under Pressure. You know how that rabbit feels going under your speeding wheels. Bright images flashing by like windshields towards a fly. Frozen in that fatal climb, but the wheels of time just pass you by.
They keep passing me by.
I know.
Thanks, Jer.
All right, see you later.
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's fantasypoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. Fantasypoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more fantasy points.